asked by the editor and owner of the magazine Aviation and Yachting, which I don't believe exists anymore, to become his art editor. And in my spare time, I did some cover illustrations and interior illustrations for him. The first cover I did was for a celebration of 40 years of progress in the aviation field. It's a picture of the Wright Memorial at
the Wilbur and Orville Wright Memorial.
Yeah, Wilbur and Wilbur Wright and Orville Wright Memorial at Kitty Hawk.
Mm-hmm.
The original of this painting was given to the surviving brother. I can't remember which one it was right now, and he wrote me a letter of thanks, but the editor got it, and I no longer have it. It might be valuable. I continue to do their covers for a while, and also, if I had ideas for airplanes, I would illustrate those. When helicopters first came out, I did a helicopter design, as helicopters of the future might evolve. This was just as the first helicopter was first flown.
Sikorsky had pioneered.
Yeah, the Sikorsky helicopter had come out, and I was doing design things like that. And then another one I did was a transportation plane that could be adapted to transporting freight or people.
The cargo plane.
Cargo plane,
mm-hmm.
Which the industry was groping for in those days. This is a picture of me when I was younger. I also did some illustrations for Skyways magazine, such as this. This is during the war. Which are possible warplanes of the future. This is looking towards the future. That seems to have been my field, one way or the other. But this type of work was mostly to keep my hand in while doing the salvage engineering. So I'll pass by that. At the end of the war, I left Briggs. There was no sense in staying with him. As a matter of fact, well before the end of the war, I discovered that some of the aircraft parts, like wings or tails, were being put in the baler, cut up with a welder and put in the baler and crushed. The company was fulfilling its contract obligations. But we were producing too much aircraft, and a lot of these parts were used for replacements, and they are no longer needed. So that field of work became pretty humdrum to me, and as soon as the first atomic bomb was dropped, I was looking for another job. Now I come back to these transparencies taken of the illustrations I made at Chrysler. Because the illustrations made at Chrysler were done on my own time, I felt I had a right to keep a record of them. Actually, after Zeter admired this one rendering, I was told to do nothing but those from then on. And I did quite a few before I left Chrysler, and I understand they appeared in people's offices and on balconies of stairways and so forth for a while, because they were, you know, a little different.
They were futuristic.
Yeah. The job I was working on at Briggs as a salvage engineer had me in contact with two men from General Motors. One man had been in charge of General Motors photographic. This was in the same building as General Motors styling. The other man had been his assistant in the same field. In other words, they were professionals in the photographic business. And I showed them one day a picture I had taken of one of these renderings. And they didn't think I did a very good job. And I finally told them what I was trying to do. I wanted to go back to New York. And instead of taking a large, clumsy portfolio of my work and going to the different design outfits, I just wanted to take good photographs along, especially the kind through which light could pass. These men volunteered to take the pictures for me.
Cliche of the time that you did take the original renderings in large, cumbersome envelopes and...
If you were an artist, which yes. I was... Mm-hmm.
Your portfolio, in other words.
Your portfolio. And I'd say the larger they were, the more impressive they might be, and the better you could render them. But
your idea was to come up with, say, slides.
I wanted to come up with slides, but not just small slides. In automotive rendering and that type of thing, highlights are pretty important in rendering them. And what I wanted to do was have transparencies in color, which I would mount over glazed plastic so light could come through. And
not the usual 2x4 or 2x2, you wanted 8x10.
Something bigger. And these men said, well, we can do that for you if we can find some Kodachrome film. This is the old Kodachrome, which actually is a very good film, always has been. And they found some film that I wouldn't call it, no, you can't call it used film, but it was film that had been around or something. They bought it at a reduced rate,
in
big sheets, surplus. And I guess nobody had a use for it, and there were big sheets, and these men knew where to go for a source. So they took this work, took pictures of it, and developed it, and came out with these, they're bigger than slides. They must be, what would you say, five inches?
4x6,
okay. Yeah. They're bigger than 3x5s, mm-hmm. And I mounted them with glazed plexiglass behind and clear in front. Mm-hmm. And when the war was over, I went. I hopped on the train and went down to New York with those in my pocket, no big portfolio. Mm-hmm. And the day I got there, I went to the smaller design outfits to get me some practice in talking to people.
Did you have a projector?
No, all I had to do was hold those up to the light, and they were that big. In the afternoon, I went around and called on the bigger designers. I called on, Dreyfus, and I called on, I'm trying to think of the name, the second biggest one then. I got job offers from each one. I got talking pretty well by afternoon.
These are industrial designers.
These are industrial designers, sorry. Then I went up to Raymond Loewy's office, and I was waiting to see, I wanted to show him to the manager, whoever he was, whom I'm sure would get excited about him and have me see Raymond Loewy. Sitting around there waiting, and I heard a big booming voice laughing, and I realized right away it was Al Fordyce, who used to be with Bell Geddes. There's no mistaking this man's voice and his personality. And
you had shared an office with him.
Yeah, well, I'd been right together with him for a while there. And so I did the usual thing. I said, is that Al Fordyce? I knew it was, and yes, it was. And he came out and, Gil Spear, And he immediately took these in to show them to Raymond Loewy. And before that afternoon was over, I had an offer to go overseas and reopen his London office. And he was telling me that later on he had reopened his Paris office, and I thought, boy, this little scheme really worked out well. And no, I did not work for Raymond Loewy. I noticed you were looking at my record. We negotiated for some time. In those days, England was very badly off, and I had small children, and I was told that I wouldn't be able to get coal for heating whatever flat I took over there. And this and that was touchy. I couldn't get my furniture would probably rot on a dock someplace and so forth. And we started having misgivings. And then we had I wouldn't say a salary dispute. It was simply that I figured out I had been able to save so much money per month, per year on my earnings, and I wanted to continue to do so and have him put that in the bank for me back here. And, pay me what the British consulate said I would need in England. And our minds couldn't meet on the salary, and eventually it dropped out. But that was a very worthy scheme, I thought, in the end. It really did me well. Maybe you better stop that for a minute. Well, of course, this was immediately after the Japanese peace, and as I was saying, I was off like a shot to New York, and I'm sure this was Raymond Loewy's first offer to anybody to reopen his European businesses, and I'm quite sure that the same job was taken by John Reinhardt, and I don't know if it got on tape, but I ended up not going with Loewy because we had a difference of opinion about what I should be paid. So that's the end of that story, but it's a pointer for younger people who might want to show their work without having a lot of bulk to take along.
And you were something of a pioneer in using transparencies rather than the actual renderings for your portfolio.
But they're definitely oversized.
Mm-hmm.
They work quite well, and I'm amazed at how well they've been preserved ever since.
Yeah.
Obviously, because I never used them. I've had them put away ever since. After the war and after the Loewy incident, I was convinced that there would be terrific opportunities to design new products that the consumer hadn't had anything coming his way for, you know, quite a few years, and there'd be a big field for new design products. I had worked in my spare time for Bob Bingman, who was a name designer in the Detroit area. Bob used to be head of the General Motors Industrial Design Studio, and apparently apparently some influential people had told him, you should open your own business. So he did. And Roy Brown and I worked for him as designers. Leo Pearl did lettering. George Martin did the modeling very skillfully.
This was in...
And we worked in the Fisher Building.
This was your... this is post GM days.
That's right. This is while I'm at Briggs.
Oh, I see.
As the end of the war became obvious.
You're moonlighting at this point.
I'm moonlighting.
Okay.
Right. Which is an old customer was, and I worked more or less as an idea man for Bob. He'd say they needed something, and I'd go home, and spend some time, keep track of my hours, and come up with sketches of. Ideas that might be used when the war was over. Even some for when the war was going on. For example, there was a corps of women flyers who transported planes across the ocean, bombers.
Mm-hmm.
And the women had some difficulty.
The WAFs.
WASPs, I guess it was.
WAFs.
Yeah.
WAAF.
Yeah, WAFs. One of the difficulties was they needed bathroom facilities on the planes. They didn't like to go out in the structure of the plane and open the bomb bay doors when they're over the middle of the cold Atlantic and do it that way. And
can't blame them.
Yeah. Being an idea man, Bob, handed me this one. And I don't remember what I came up with, but the idea was some sort of a portable facility that could be put in the airplane to take care of the toilet needs. But that's what I mean.
Something akin to railroad cars.
Yeah, right. Another problem during the war was fold-up shelters for fighter pilots who are out on the field on alerts. You know, they needed to sleep out there right next to the airplanes. And I came up with... a thing that looked like a big suitcase and folded out to become a shelter with beds and so forth, which was later used for camping after the war. But I started doing that. We worked on Bell helicopters after the war. I came up with the idea of having a T T-shaped control pod that would have dual controls on it and instruments, but under which the pilots could see through windows in the bottom of the nose of the aircraft, of the helicopters. But we worked on things like that. And
this is at Robert Bingham Associates in Detroit.
Yeah, this is Bob Bingman.
B-I-N-G-M-A-N.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the last years of the war and shortly after.
And shortly after, mm-hmm. Correct. We did, still in transportation fields, we did motorboats. I'm trying to see if I can find any of the illustrations. At Bingman's we worked on Richardson boats near Buffalo, New York. We worked on Bell helicopters, also near Buffalo. And we also did Chris-Crafts, but on a rather irregular basis.
Working on exterior designs.
Exterior designs. They would have their boat carpenters interpret sketches, and they would become boats. And it was very frustrating. Bob didn't care for that at all and got out of it after a while. But we worked on that type of thing. We also did some advertising illustrations, which were really designs for some companies for magazine illustrations, but they really never made the road. I had the idea, as I was saying before, that there'd be a big field for industrial designers after the war. So I went into business with a man named Federico, F-E-D-E-R-I-C-O, first name Joe. Joe was the selling partner. He would go on the road and get jobs to do. I was the production partner. I would design and deliver and confer with the customers. And in some cases, I would stop and call on other prospective customers on the way.
What Joe, kind of clientele did he have?
His clientele was mostly the area around Buffalo, into Pennsylvania, New York State, up into Canada. And we did, one job we did was the first plastic glass, I mean drinking glass. The industry wasn't into that yet. I had to study glass making and things like that to successfully do this. We did silverware, things to eat, salt shakers, forks, knives, and so forth, that type of thing.
For a particular company, or?
Well, for different companies. Mm-hmm. We did instruments for instrument companies. I did work for Hickok Jewelry, which was interesting. This really wasn't successful. I had put my savings away in a bank in downtown Detroit.
Why was it not successful?
Well, people didn't want new designs.
Ah.
Not that much. Mm-hmm. They had the tooling left from before the war. They just started
right.
producing the old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And being young, I didn't realize that these business people want to make a buck. They're not into it for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And if people would buy what they were making before the war, okay, they weren't going to pay for new tooling, and people would buy it because they didn't have it.
Sure.
You know, they needed it.
I've had it for 4 years.
Right. So this didn't work out too well, but I had preserved my savings, and I gave it a try for a specified time and then got out. And that brought me to Ford.
In what way?
Well, the rent controls went off. I didn't own a house.
Mm-hmm.
The rent controls around Detroit went off, and I realized I needed a house. Well, if a young person had to get a mortgage on a house, he needed a steady employer. And I saw a black bordered want ad in the paper one day. It had a black border around it, Ford Motor Company. And I thought, I'll go around there. I probably can get a job, but I'll be darned if I'll stay more than 6 months because
what
I was
were they advertising for
a stylist.
Stylist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Still call them stylus in 46.
Yeah, they call them stylus.
In 45.
And whatever, yeah, right after, it was, maybe it was 46, what was it?
47.
47,
yeah.
Okay. So I answered the ad, but I was in love with industrial design. I didn't like the formality of automobile design, you know, where you design a side and you design a front, or you combine it with somebody else's front end and
component
like that. I figured, okay, I'll stay with this company for 6 months. Then I can get a letter stating I have a steady job, get a mortgage, and move on to something interesting. And that's how I started with Ford. I'd like to go back a little bit, if you don't mind. When I was with Bingman, Roy Brown and I, working for Bingman, designed the second Stout Scarab.
Did you?
Rear engine car.
Who had done the first?
Well, I don't know. It was done before the war.
Back and in the late 30s.
Yeah, I doubt that the first one was designed by industrial designers.
Probably by Stout himself.
I'm sure. I was going to say that. But I'm a little lost in the details here. It was a very short thing.
Was it a commission from Mr. Stout?
No. That's it. We had two men. One, I think, was Fraser. Another was a prominent automotive executive from some other company. And they wanted to start an automobile company.
Kaiser? Edgar Kaiser.
Well, not yet, but
okay.
They took over this old automobile plant,
yeah. And
I can't remember what plant it was. I have down here in my notes that I made this morning that I think they produced the last car to use the X-Cord body. You know, that body was passed on to several different companies, or they bought the tooling for it. But this get-together of these two men didn't last very long, but we did a job there. George Martin did the clay modeling on it. There were some inexperienced draftsmen involved with it. I don't remember who they were, but they laid out the buck for the clay model, or the buck is a wooden framework that goes underneath the clay that you stick the clay onto, and they made very many too many bulkheads. We outlined the shape we wanted, and in order to cut down on time, somebody had the idea of cutting out a whole lot of bulkheads that would just be an inch less than the final clay shape, not allowing for us to change the clay very much. But we clay modeled that, and they built.
You and Roy?
Well, George Martin did most of the modeling.
Yes.
But we pitched in some, but we were busy on other projects. But I think Stout made two of those. He had adapted an engine from some car, put it in the back, and it chain drove the rear axle. In other words, the engine sat above the axle. It made for a rather high rear end, which didn't help streamlining the car. As a matter of fact, when he took the first one out and ran it, it wouldn't cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tied the usual multitude of ribbons to the back end where he wanted to see what the airflow was, and he found the air was flowing in reverse to what he expected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second one, he had to turn that around somehow or other. The one man, Fraser, went on to combine with Kaiser, and they started the Kaiser-Fraser company.
No.
This was a sort of a nucleus that didn't quite gel, but what do you say?
What happened to the Scarab?
Nothing.
You did the prototype?
Yeah, the last time I saw the prototype, it was in the museum in Detroit, across from the art museum.
Detroit Historical Museum.
Yeah, it was in there for several years.
Was it?
And I never been back since, so I don't know what happened to it.
So you were...
It was fiberglass.
It was fiberglass.
And Bingman had an agreement with Libby Owens, I think,
mm-hmm.
to develop things in fiberglass.
Mm-hmm.
We had been using a material just before that, during the war, that I was either hemp or coconut fibers mixed with plastic. This was the predecessor to fiberglass.
Mixed with rosins, perhaps?
Yes.
Yes.
And in fact, Roy and I had an offer from the company to come down to Toledo anytime we wanted to and make any shapes. If we wanted to make different fenders for our cars, they'd be glad to make them. They were doing all sorts of free work to you know, to attract attention to the product and get some experience with it. But I believe that car body was made with fiberglass, and it was one of the first, if not the first.
What was Stout's purpose in asking for a second Scarab to be designed and built?
Well, I'm not sure. He was obviously pushing the rear engine car.
That was its main feature.
That was the main feature, plus the streamlining. As you know, he you know, was into aircraft and was an advocate of having the proper streamlining, getting the airflow right. He had other ideas too. For example, we had odd doors on this car. I'm trying to remember the layout. There was only one, I think there was one big door on the right side so passengers could get out on the curb.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I think, only one small door next to the driver on the left side so the driver could get out. Either that or it had three doors. I don't remember. It might have had two passenger doors on the right and only the driver's door on the left. But he was into a few other innovations, and I don't recall them. And with a man like Bingman having his mind into it, and Roy and I, why, there were probably a few other innovations. It was a rather fat-looking thing.
This was an ovoid, egg-shaped vehicle with a rear engine.
Yeah. Do you recall the old post-war Hudson had a little bit of a bathtub upside down look to it?
Yeah.
Well, as a matter of fact, the Kaiser Frazers looked a little that way.
Oh, well,
this was going in that direction. We tried not to, but it was a little tubby looking.
But
I thought
Mr. Fraser was involved in that. Was he backing?
I believe. He was. Now,
Mr. Stout?
These men didn't have money themselves, but they were able to attract money.
Joseph Fraser.
I think that was him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember who the other man was.
Well,
but
yeah.
If you Bob's gone, but if you were to ask Roy Brown, he probably could tell you something about that. I'll give you these notes. Well, that was another one when I was still going to Pratt.
Okay. That's very interesting.
I'm sorry if I took too long on that one.
No, that's very interesting.
I jumped back there. Okay, with Ford, I got the job.
Who interviewed you, do you remember?
I don't remember. Now, I believe Bob Gregory had left there already.
In 47, uh-huh. Yes.
And young Henry Ford had come in, and the well-known story, he had taken over the company and was modernizing it. Who's the man with the mustache? You better shut that. I don't recall who interviewed me at Ford. I think it was some assistant to Tom Hibbard.
And Tom Hibbard was?
Tom Hibbard was running styling at the time, and I believe he had been the assistant to Bob Gregory, mm-hmm. who I never met.
Mm-hmm.
But the man who was really running it there then was George Snyder, who had just come in from Oldsmobile, I believe.
S-Y-N-D-E-R.
Yeah, S-N-Y-D-E-R, George. And Hibbard's name is spelled H-I-B-B-A-R-D. Snyder really hired me. He represented the more modern automotive stylist who was going to take over there. And I understand from Snyder that Hibbard did not want to hire me. I never noticed that Tom Hibbard treated me badly or anything. I had to go to his meetings when he was running it, and we got along fine. But Snyder told me later that Hibbard hadn't wanted to hire me. There was starting to be a clash between the new and the old, as actually quite a few General Motors people came in to run it the way GM was run.
Pretty much at Ernie Breach's request, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm quite sure.
Or behest.
Yeah, behest came in. A little later, John Oswald came in. And I learned later that John Oswald actually brought Snyder in, but John Oswald himself didn't make the move for another couple of months. Gene Bournay came in. This all happened fairly quickly. Oswald, I think, was chief body engineer, and as such, he was over George Snyder, and Bournay was an assistant to Snyder. At a later date, Tom Hibbard left, and I didn't see him any longer. Gene started running the various studios and had me supplying ideas for the Ford studio, and in a very short time had me managing the Ford studio. At the time I started in there, we had several full-size clay models of the 49 Ford 2B. One was the bustle back and the other was a fast back. The design for the front end, although not perfected, was already there. That is the little spinner with the fat wings on each side. And it's always been an interesting subject as to where this design, this particular design came from, that is. And there are apparently several claimants. It'd be interesting to find out the truth.
Who was your candidate?
I don't really have a candidate. I hope no one will sue me for saying things, but I don't think the Walker people originated that idea.
That would be Oros and Engel.
That would be Oros and Engel and George Walker himself. They may have adapted it. I'm trying to think of a name. Oh, to start in again, this front end was quite an innovation over previous grills, which mostly consisted of either egg crates or strips of bright metal. And it not only was unique, but it was quite successful. So I think it'd be interesting to find out who did it or came up with the idea. The reason I said I didn't think the Walker people did it was because
they were consulting for Ford at the time.
They were consulting for Ford at the time, but I don't think they were consulting for Ford when this originated. The story I used to get was that the design originated as a quarter scale model in someone's basement, and the two people involved are supposed to be Dick Khalil and Bob Kodo. I should say and or.
K-A-L-E-A-L.
Right, and Kodo is C-O-D-O.
I think it's K-O-T-O, is it not?
You're correct, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. excuse me, Bob, if you ever hear that. the thing here is that this must have been done at the tail end of World War II or just after. And I think Kodo was in the Indiana area, been working for Studebaker. The design, in a way, looks like something that might have been done for Raymond Loewy, who was a consultant designer for Studebaker, in somewhat competition with the Studebaker designers. Although it's the body and the front end in question are somewhat a little fatter than you might find in a Studebaker shape. And I don't think the Walker people were involved in that area and at that time. And certainly it doesn't look like something that, to me, that Joe Oros would come up with. I think that We shut it off. Elwood Engel might come up with an idea like that, but it doesn't look like his type of thing. Dick Khalil, the person, I've heard that this may have been done in his basement or in Cotto's basement. I don't think Khalil would carry a design like that. He might, for example, and I'm just using my imagination here, he might convince Bob Cotto to design something for him in one of their basements, and that he, Dick Khalil, would take it out and sell it. But I'm going to let the story drop there because I really don't know the truth. But
well,
it's
pertinent at this point to point out that that particular design did win the competition for the 49.
Yeah, it became the front end, and adaptations of it were made for several years after.
Largely by Joe Oros, I think.
Well, not necessarily. We had a similar competition at Ford Motor Company where the company designers and the company design studios were doing designs, and the Walker studios, who were outside our studios, were designing more or less in competition with us. At least we thought of it that way. And I know there was a similar situation where Cotto was with Raymond Loewy versus the company studios there. We sometimes would feel pretty bad in the company studios to find that Walker had presented ideas very similar to what we had been working on in the company studios, and had sold it to top management, with whom he had closer contact.
In the person of Ernie Breach.
Yeah, as his rather than as ours.
You think there had been some skullduggery going on there?
I know, I found this out at a later date, that some of our clay modelers were working at night in George's studios. I can't swear by that, but some people have told me that that's the type of thing that was going on. So I don't know where that front end came from. I ran the Ford studio for a while after that, and we adapted it. We put two spinners instead of one, and so forth. But we worked on perfecting the clay model shapes, and at that time in 1947, there was some question as to whether the bustleback body should be brought out or the fastback. There was a big question as to whether fastbacks were the coming shape or whether bustlebacks were.
Can you define those two?
Well, the bustleback is the car that was produced. It's back, right in back of the back seat passenger's head. The roof came down, of course, with a back window, which we call a backlight. And it came down at a fairly steep angle, and then the deck lid started out more or less horizontally from there and went on aft. This is the general shape of most cars since then. In a fastback, the roof shape continued aft of the rear seat passengers' heads in a downward shape, and more or less provided a bigger, higher trunk space. It usually terminated someplace above the license plate, of course, but it was the more streamlined of the two. But in some ways, it made for having blind areas in back. I believe the company at first was going to come out with both, and then probably decided that they couldn't afford to put both on the market, that they really didn't need to. If the car was going to succeed, they only needed one body. And I believe the tools for the fastback were made and gathered dust in the storage of the company that made the tooling in Philadelphia. At the moment, I can't recall their name. They made big tools and the heavy things like that. But at any rate, that's always been a big mystery.
Still unsolved.
Still unsolved, and I'd probably, if you interviewed some of these people, you could find out which one lays claim to it. Let's see, what can we go on to from here? After bringing out the, we got the 49 Ford out on the market and started making changes that we found were necessary for the following year, changing some shapes. But soon after that, Gene Bordenay wanted to start a an advanced styling studio, which was to originate fresh styling themes that the production car studios might use, and also to break in or teach newly hired styling people, of which we didn't have enough, and also to develop and test potential styling leaders.
This was something of an innovation of Bordenay's, was it not?
It was, and I notice in a organization chart I have someplace around here that he has advanced styling right under the head office, that things had to pass through there first. I actually hired some people that who I think of as being young kids, but I notice they're retiring now. But we would get people who had, perhaps some training in airbrushing or illustration or whatnot. They would not be complete designers. Mm-hmm. There were no schools for that then, especially for automobile designers. And we would interview and hire men who seemed to have potential, and then have them work in the advanced styling studio, not only furnishing us with fresh ideas, but also learning how to, really come up with ideas and how to get them across, get some experience. And then we would have the, I would either recommend them to a production studio, or somebody from the production studio would come and ask me. Mm-hmm. And eventually these people would be transferred to a production studio to work as production stylists. Of course, it was a lot of fun coming up with new ideas. I found, for example, that if I had a man who didn't seem to come up with ideas, either from stage fright or just had never done it, I could sometimes feed him an idea, and once he had done it, he'd come up with his own ideas. It was just a sort of a over-the-crest type of thing. In this studio, we also, as I mentioned, develop potential styling leaders. I'm trying to think of some names of some people we had, but if a designer looked as if he was doing a pretty good job in a production studio, sometimes we'd break him loose and bring him into the advanced styling studio and give him freelance to do what he wanted, handle a whole project, develop some ideas that he had had but couldn't use in the production studios, give him a chance. Let's see, one I can think of is Ken Spencer. He started with me, went to production, and several years later came back, did his own thing, and then went on to get a supervisor's job. This happened to several people.
The process is very important. This was an innovation that you've not seen anywhere else.
That's right.
Yeah, so the concept of the advanced design studio.
Yeah. We had several other people who actually were well-known in the industry come into advanced styling. Gordon Burig came in there and worked for I forget how long. I just got to know him and said, Gordon, do your own thing. And he worked on what he wanted to.
For the innovators.
Yeah, and presented his ideas to whomever he wanted to in the company. And, I'd back him up as much as possible. We had a few other people like that come through advanced styling.
Was Alex Tremulous another?
Alex Tremulous came in with me. He worked for me for a while. Alex had a hell of a lot of ideas. He was interested in mostly in aerodynamic shapes. He liked the thing that looked like the rocket of that day, the sharp-nosed, fast thing. And later on, when advanced styling grew bigger, to where we had several separate studios and had moved to the new styling building, Alex was given the chance to teach, and he did a lot of very effective work there, taking over new designers, finding them, and
young apprentice designers.
And working with them, looking over their shoulders. Mm-hmm. I found what we were doing. I had done that before, sort of as a side thing. A cousin of my wife's was a very good architect in the Florida area. Mm-hmm. He worked for one of the universities, and I would visit him and go into the architectural studios he was in. I found him doing the same thing, except he was officially teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep going around to these fellows and talking with them and encouraging them and making suggestions, and pretty soon you'd have a guy doing a good job. And that's what Alex was doing too.
Very effective. Another innovation, I suspect, in the industry.
Oh, I think
were
so.
Were other design studios doing that as well?
The other companies? I'm not sure. I really am not. I don't think Chrysler did. I don't know if General Motors did.
Was this one of Bourdonnais' ideas?
I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was.
Train young designers.
Huh? Yeah. Organize it that way. Snyder faded out of the picture after a while. And we had Jean Bourdonnais running things pretty much, but as the assistant manager of the whole department under Charlie Waterhouse.
Oh, yeah. Who had come in from the from body engineering.
Right. Perhaps you've heard the story before, but when Hibbard left, now I recall, Hibbard left, and I'm trying to remember his position. He used to be head of the German Ford company. Been with Ford through the war.
B.Y. Talberg.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talberg. T-A-L-L-B-E-R-G.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Talberg, I guess, was somehow over the engineering group that was over styling. And he held a meeting that the studio heads had to come to. And he was going to announce the new manager of styling. And he called for Charlie Waterhouse, and Charlie didn't come in. There was some embarrassment here. We had to sit around for about an hour waiting for the new manager to come. We didn't know who he was. And apparently somebody forgot to tell him. When they went to his office, he wasn't there. He was gone on some other quest. But Charlie came in, and he's a very, very just man, and he got onto it pretty quickly, but I don't think he understood stylists at first. He and I became friends later on.
He was an engineer.
Right. He gradually got more sympathetic with our viewpoint, and would put a scrap up for our viewpoint eventually. But again, it was the old story that styling was under engineering, and it was difficult.
Which was common in those days.
Yeah, it was the way that things were done.
Yeah.
I kind of got led off here. In advanced styling, I came up with the idea for the retractable hardtop. And I don't know if you're interested in going over that.
Yes, what year was that when you came up with that first concept?
Let me look at the rendering. I think it was 1948. I think it was early in 48.
How did it come about?
I was driving down Southfield Road, which was a surface road at that time, and I stopped at a traffic light. This is going to work in the morning, and next to me was I forget whether it was a Pontiac or a Chevrolet, so-called hardtop convertible. It did not convert. It had a hard top. It did not have a pillar between the front and rear. Well, it didn't have a B pillar.
One of the very first of the hard tops.
Oh, yes, that's right. But they... But General Motors had quite a successful styling package there. They had the faster lines of a convertible without some of the disadvantages of a convertible. In other words, they had a hard top instead of a cloth top, and it was smooth rather than bumpy. But I resented them calling it a hardtop convertible. I think that's the name, or it was a similar name. And I very well knew that this thing did not convert. When we stopped at the traffic light, I asked the young man who was proudly sitting behind the steering wheel, "What kind of a car is that?" And he said, "This is a hardtop convertible." And I said, "Oh, gee, is it? Let's see you make it convert." And of course, I got a kind of a snide look from him. But I went on driving to work, and while in traffic, I started thinking, I bet I could make one work, you know, with a hard top, and I could get it down. And by the time I got to the studio, I had convinced myself, well, you're not going to put this this rooftop over the hood. It'll have to go over the deck or in the trunk area. Now, in those days, we were trending towards using up less room of our package for the engine. In other words, a long hood wasn't good. It would be better to use up the length of the car in providing more trunk space. And a V8 engine lent itself to that. It was shorter, say, than a inline 8. And there was quite a bit of waste space that had grown between the grill and the radiator. So we were trending towards moving the front seat and the back seat further forward in the car, and we're getting longer trunks. And as an advanced stylist, I was with this trend, and I simply figured, well, maybe it will have to stretch the back end of a car a little bit more, but I bet I can get that roof down on there. And it's one of those things that gels in your mind quite quickly. I reasoned that I could shorten the roof to make the problem easier by having the windshield extend further into the front of the roof, and by having the backlight, or back window if you would, extend further into the back of the roof, all of which would make the roof shorter. It wasn't for some time later, I don't know whether it was a couple of months later or more, that I got around to sketching the idea, because we were working on other things. And I made a cheap sketch. It's in this book about the retractable hardtop. I made what we call a cheap sketch on my Tanny's paper. You take some silver pencil and sketch right on the black paper, apply a little color, maybe a few airbrush highlights, use soft colored pencils or pastels and smear them around a little bit, and you very quickly have a picture of your idea. And it's a good way to visualize things. You don't lose your idea. You don't lose your initial feel for it. And I might say that when an artist, that is an artist designer, draws something, he is going through complete visualization for himself. You know, when you think of something, you can't think of the front end of a car when you're thinking of designs and the back end at the same time. The artist, in a way, can. He records what he was thinking for one part, puts it down on paper, and quickly moves to another part, and pretty soon he has the whole thing together. I've often heard people say, "I can think of things like that, but somehow I never can make them gel," and this is the difference. But anyway, I made one of these quick sketches, and I had already initiated the thing that we did there. We kept a record. We numbered everything, and we had we required the at least in my studio, the artist or designer to sign his drawing, put the date down, take a number out of a number book, put the number down, and then record in the book what that number represented, and then call over two other people, adults, and because some of them were younger than adults, and have them sign it too as witnesses. And that's why I know when this sketch was done because it's got that on it. This becomes a rather long story. I almost could read it to you out of that
The retractable book. Hardtop?
Yeah, the retractable.
Fine, please do.
Should I do that?
Yes.
Okay.
That is an important part of your career.
Yeah, well, it kind of shows how things go. I'll see if I can find it.
Obviously, the convertible hardtop, which you are credited with originating, as an independent advanced design, part of your duties at the design studio, would make a very good case history for this particular project.
Yeah, it probably would. It didn't end up successfully, but I'll try to run through it. As I say, I made my initial sketch quite a bit later, and the date on the sketch is 10/1/48.
The very first final sketch.
The very first perspective concept sketch. And it shows a car with the top down with a smooth rear deck, no folded cloth top showing, and there's raindrops falling on it. And next to it is a sketch of the same car with the top rising up out of the back, and another sketch with the top all the way up.
Out of the deck lid.
Coming out of the deck lid area. I made some quick eighth scale drawings and proved to myself that with a little adaptation of the Ford package, of that day, that is,
yes.
That there was room to do this. I originally, and as it shows in my original sketch, wanted to bring the roof down on top of the deck. The space at the back of the roof would come down over the tail lamps and the license plate and the bumper guards of the car. Since there's an opening for the back window that would come down there, it would allow these things to show or be seen or protrude through that area. The back window or backlight would independently fold down behind the back of the back seat. Jean Bordenay, when he saw the idea, didn't want to do it that way. He wanted to have the deck, he said, work it out so the roof can go under the deck. Well, he felt that if the roof shape went down over the deck, it would determine the shape of the rear end of the car.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to do that.
Right.
I felt that if it went under, it would be more difficult. The deck lid would have to swallow the roof,
mm-hmm.
and the roof being under it might cause the deck lid to have a different shape anyway. It would have to be bigger to swallow it,
mm-hmm.
or to contain it, which proved to be true in the end.
Sort of a clamshell opening.
Yeah, but time went on. We didn't do anything because we're still working on other projects.
You're working on the early 50s Fords by this time.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm not sure what, because this is a spell of time. But at any rate, the first attempt I made to get something working was a flat rendering, or rather it looked like a rendering. I took the package drawing, cut it out in stiff cardboard, that is illustration board, and mounted this on a background of heavier cardboard, then cut out a roof that was separate and which could be moved. Made a little arm out of a flat piece of metal that would swing the back of it, and then took a paper clip and made a little finger crank. In other words, you could reach up to this picture, turn this little crank made out of a wire paper clip, and swing the roof down. It would disappear behind the rear deck of the car, and I made the deck come up and swallow it with a separate piece of cardboard. this sort of intrigued people. Mm-hmm. People started playing with it. The few people who could get into advanced styling. For example, we would have Ernie Breach would come in sometimes mm-hmm. and sit down and just chew the fat about cars. Mm-hmm. I guess he just liked to get in there and see some of the unusual things we were doing. And of course, we found out what people like he were thinking, mm-hmm. too. But I did this, and finally Gene said, well, why don't you take this a little further? So I did the same thing to the same scale, 8th scale, in a 3-dimensional model. I have a picture of it here. Larry Wilson was the head modeler in the studio, and he was very good with metal. And he hammered out a little copper roof for this model. We cast a little deck out of fiberglass and cast the rest of the body out of plaster, and made a few more copper arms and things, and had a little working model, which the viewer...